Okay, it's the last class, and I really be honest that I know some people slept deep asleep, they left the class. Once you left, I'm not really actually honestly surprised about that. I'm definitely aware that most people find history boring. I'm very aware of that. I know I'm in a distinct minority in this, but it was so much fun. I had a lot of fun. So everyone who came, parts of the year, other parts of the year, who are here and who aren't here, that was really a lot of fun. So much fun that I think I want to do it next year again also and go weiter. Even though I know it's going to be a challenge, I have to change, so I don't have to go head to head with your Rav Fuchs. What can I tell you? Now, we hit the topic of printing of Shas earlier. But I was lacking the Bible. The Bible of printing of Shas is this sefer. This is the Bible. It is printed, it is written by Rafael Nassan Nata Rabinowitz, Rabinovich. He wrote a sefer called Dikduke Sofer. I'm not sure you're aware what the Dikduke Sofer is?
I've seen it.
They have it in the Beis Medrash. Dikduke Sofer compares all known Kisveyad and Prince of Shas, and attempts to show what the different Girsos were, who had them, etc. It's, you know, one of my statements is the opposite of wrong isn't right, and it's well known, or in some places it's well known, that the Chazanish was quite against the Gizofrim. But Rabbi Soloveitchik also didn't give it much, pay much attention to it. He didn't really pay much attention to it. It's a little more complicated than that. In terms of hachra, in other words, in terms of changing accepted psak, it's really very difficult to do that because of kisveyad and different, you know, variant readings, etc. But still, it's not completely wrong just because it's not completely right. And specifically, you know,
does it try to find out what reading is more halachically correct?
Well, again, see, the problem is life's not a vacuum, and there are people who like don't exist today, basically, who would like to try to make much too much out of it. And try to overstate the importance of variant readings. Anyway, so this is the book on it. So now that I have it, I wanted to go back over it anyway. And as this is the last class of the year, I also want to sort of like also try to simultaneously give last thoughts for a year of Jewish history. Which was, again, it was a lot of fun. I mean, I'll tell you, the truth is when the Balkari didn't show up last year, Pesach time, and I got to learn Shir Shirim from a cloth without preparation, that was more fun. That's like a one-time experience. I have a secret desire that he won't show up Chol Moed Sukkos, and I'll get to see exactly how well I know Kehelas. That'll be a much bigger challenge, because Kehelas I don't understand as well as Shir Shirim. And I understand it relatively well with Rashi. Kehelas, I'm somewhat in the dark still, even though I did a lot of nice work on it this year. Maybe a little more next year. Okay, anyway, let's get on. Let's get on to, I'm going to start out like, you know, as you know, words of conclusion are, in my opinion, the greatest sin, of course, of a historian is deliberate falsification of history. And I think there's no question. I think that's the greatest sin, historical sin that can be committed, ki'ilu, in terms of, if you're a professional historian, then the greatest sin you can commit is falsification of history. Of course, history is complicated. And as I've said, you know, everyone's opinionated about Jews, and Jews are the most opinionated about Jews. So, to verify the facts are harder than you would think. And to use what's called objective observers, and no one's objective when it comes to Jews. Everyone's very opinionated. So there is a certain amount of analysis you always have to do when engaged in Jewish history. And I'm going to see when we go through this whole piece what I consider a very classic example of it. Now, the second greatest sin of historians is called projection. Projection means I live in a certain time, and I must understand that there's at least slight, if not deep, differences in other times. That's very critical to understand. Very critical. Now, I'll give you two outside Jewish history examples. One is, I don't know, anyone here Churchillian? No? Churchillian? No, you're not. You're definitely not. If you were, you would be Churchillian. Okay, yeah. Okay. So, the best, unfortunately, wasn't finished. The official biography is by Martin Gilbert. And Martin Gilbert did a decent job. But William Manchester did a much better job and penetrated specifically the mindset of the 20s and 30s of 1900 to 1940 much deeper than Gilbert did. And it shows in his book. In a different example, biographical examples like this. There's a relatively popular author whose last name is McCulloch. Or McCulloch. I don't know how you pronounce this. You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, M-U-L-L-O-C-H.
Yeah, okay. McCulloch, whatever the guy's name is. He's most famous for his biography on Truman. And his biography on Truman is absolutely unbelievable. It's great. It's unbelievable. It's such a good work. Unfortunately, we had it. My father-in-law brought it to me like 4 or 5 years ago. And my wife lent it to somebody, to a mutual relative, and that relative promptly lost it. And I'm still upset about it. I mean, whatever. I'm not that upset, but you know, that's one of those books that's worth reading once every 2 or 3 years because he just did such good work on it, such very good work on it, and he penetrated Truman deeply. And he doesn't openly argue this, but you know, part of his understanding, and it's probably true, but I can't. This is something you could get into really big arguments with American historians on: was Truman the last Jacksonian Democrat? Jacksonian Democrats today are Republicans. That's a fact. That's like a fact. I mean, there are some left, but they're the minority. Most people who originally were Jacksonian Democrats today are Republicans. So, anyway, so he has another biography about John Adams. Now, he did not penetrate John Adams, not even close. Didn't understand the 1700s well. And besides not understanding the 1700s, he doesn't know anything about constitutional law. And John Adams is one of the greatest constitutional theorists who ever lived. He is more or less the author of the American Constitution with its faults. It's not completely perfect. I'm not saying it is. But it's still functional around 230 years? 220 years already? That's an impressive accomplishment. That is a quite impressive accomplishment. And if you don't have a deep understanding of constitutional law, then I personally would have advised him not to write the biography on John Adams. Most people are not that upset about it, but I guess they don't realize how important, that's John Adams' real contribution to history. Not being an ambassador to France, and not this and not that, and not president for 4 years, that's not his real contribution. If you want to know who is John Adams, the answer is the Constitution of the United States of America. That is John Adams. Okay. Fine. Now, Max Diamant has a good point. I said before that I really don't like his book. He's actually quite not religious. But he does make a good point. Someone once gave me his book, and I read through it pretty quickly. And there's only one good point there, so I remember the point throughout the book. And his good point is that though Chinese and Greeks still exist today, there's a vast cultural difference between China today and China of 2,000-3,000 years ago. I mean, there is some continuity between old China and new China. But I'm not into China, so I can't really. It's not.
I learned that there's economic growth in China, and 2,000 years ago, for China for the last 2,800-900 years, the state living standards of Chinese have been the same.
Fascinating. That's very, could be David Zvi Halevi. That's fascinating.
That's what I learned in economics.
I would have to, everything, you see, when you're learning things on the basic level, you have to see what the substance is behind that. Could be, anyway, the point is there is a certain continuity in Chinese society, Greek society, I mean, ancient Greeks and modern Greeks, you know, like ancient Greeks were the terror of the world. They were militarily. The Greek mercenaries were the terror of the world for 200 to 300 years before Alexander the Great. The Persians hired Greek mercenaries before they, whatever. The intellectual explosion of from about, let's say, 450 BCE to 250 BCE, unbelievable. Today, I don't know, when was the last major Greek thinker? Really? It's like, one of the old jokes on European history is the last great major French general was Napoleon Bonaparte.
It was.
Okay, there's that, if you want to debate that over dinner, Josh, I'm happy to talk about it over dinner. That's an interesting question, but not now. But many people think you're right. All modern military tactics is based on study of Napoleon. That's where it started from. Okay, so I didn't bother bringing the book upstairs, but So Diamat was there. Diamat makes the point.
Say again?
With
Napoleon, because Lafayette was American.
That's not a real riot. We could discuss that, but no. It's too off the topic. Okay, even though I brought it up. Okay, so Diamat's point is Jewish society has a continuity to it. And I found it really fascinating because Diamat himself is not really, he's really quite secular. And the only truth to the continuity of Jewish society is in, like, really seriously Orthodox Jewish society. That's what that's continuity. This whole Hakdama gets me to one of the books I decided to read. See, I thought I would get a little farther. So months ago, I bought a book by Jonathan Israel called Jews in the Age of Mercantilism. Excellent book. The Jewish historians like have a love-hate affair with him because he's not really a Jewish historian. He's really an economic historian. So they have this like they reluctantly admit that he defined early his book is the first book specifically on early modern Jewish history, and they're like perplexed why an economic historian is the one who wrote it. And they don't like everything he says. But I honestly, so far, having read his main competition by someone whose last name is Ruderman, who I'm curious to find out exactly how he's related to Rabbi Yaakov Yitzchak Ruderman, the former Rosh Yeshiva of Neri Yisrael, and one assumes that he's at most a second cousin.
How
did
you get the
last name? Ruderman? I've never heard of it. It's like Ruderman is like a very uncommon. It's not like Rosen. It's like,
I mean, it's not that complicated.
Have you ever heard? I've never heard. I have a decent memory. Decent. I have not met anyone in 30 years whose last name is Ruderman. Never. Not once. Not one person in 30 years. It's like Meiselman, okay? If their last name's Meiselman, they're related to Rabbi Meiselman. I mean, I don't know if they are, but it's very highly likely. But it's true, there is. I met a guy whose last name is Wetzenstein, who we can't prove if we're related or not.
Wetzenstein?
It's almost the same name. It's basically the same name. Wetzenstein.
I don't know if I've heard another Wetzenstein besides...
What?
I don't know if I know another
word. I have my father, whatever. I have second cousins in Chicago. But it's a rare last name. So he claims... he claims that rabbis were upset, felt threatened by losing the position of spiritual authority by the printing of Shas, and they tried to limit it and control it because they didn't want to lose the monopoly and spiritual control over the masses. You know, the knowledge revolution is definitely possibly. The printing press, Gutenberg and the printing press, which was around 1450, is possibly the greatest, cultural event, definitely of the last 1,000 years. Possibly. And there's no question that there is a definite relationship between Gutenberg and the printing press and the Reformation. a Catholic Church losing its spiritual monopoly over Western Europe. There's no question. I don't doubt that. That is right. You know, if you would have said that, I wouldn't have said you're probably right. You have to absolutely documentation. It's a little more complicated. It's not direct, it's really sort of indirect. But yeah, there is a certain truth to that, and there's no question that the Catholic Church attempted to limit knowledge. The problem is Torah has always been meant for everybody. Now, it is a dichotomy that it's true everyone didn't always engage in serious learning. But that was not the ideal. The ideal is everyone should be engaged in serious learning. If major machlokas rishonim, I don't think I mentioned it in this class, but there's major machlokas rishonim, if everyone in the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim were immense scholars or not, were there amaratzim, were there people who were basically ignorant then, or no, everyone's really on a very high level. The Rambam is of the opinion that Katan Shemnesheyan, the smallest of all the women at that time, were on the level of the Nabi Yechezkel. So she does a Rambam. So there definitely are exceptions. And as Chazal say, in the times of Chizkiyamel, they check. Midaba, they checked the entire Eretz Yisrael, and all the kids were experts even in Titus. That's the hardest part. Wait till you get there, Josh. That's the hardest part of Shas. The hardest.
Great.
Yeah, no. Just plugging away. You got the inertia. See, I hit Titus first, but for a number of reasons, which I can explain to you not now also. But it's sort of like you let the inertia of Shas, once you get that far, if you get through concussion, I think it's a little harder actually. But you let the inertia of everything else carry you through. So anyway, Bekitzer, the point is it is a Jewish ideal to have people educated in Torah. Now it's true that we do have concern about not Torah and anti-Torah things in print. That's true. I'm not going to argue about that. That's true. It's definitely true that Rabbanim would put someone in Chayra, would excommunicate someone for printing Kfira. I'm not going to argue that point. But that does not mean in terms of printing Shas. In terms of printing Shas. No, so it's like this. It's the way he doesn't bother. That's right. Well, Slipkin is a different issue. Not now. We can discuss that also off the books if you want. But
the Gemara talks about, Amoraim being wrong scientifically, and Jesus, and all these other things.
Okay. Now you're getting into different issues. The issues of Torah and science. This is a Torah and science in 1500 were not, really basically non-existent.
Maybe the rabbis didn't want to expose the Jews to all the heretical concepts in the Talmud.
I don't think so. The Imam says no. It's amazing. So let's just go on a little more. Let's go on a little more. Now, the way really to disprove this is show history of Jewish printing in a more wide range. When we see the history of Jewish printing and the history of Jewish printing of Shas, then you'll see it's like it's hard for me to believe he didn't bother reading this book. This has been around, this was printed over 100 years ago. Again, this is the Bible of this topic. And maybe not, I don't know. Anyway, so again, Gutenberg printed the first Bible in 1450. Now, there is a technical problem with Gutenberg, that we don't know exactly when he printed his different works, because he wasn't nice, Ki'ilu. And that means he didn't sign his name and didn't date anything. So, there is a lot of historical confusion about exactly when Gutenberg printed his different things, and then he broke up with his partner, and his partner did name and date things and didn't bother saying that he got the idea from Gutenberg. So you can well imagine that in terms of non-Jewish printing, there's a lot of historical questions about it. Okay, just wait a second. Now, I'm going to... let me just write a note to get to this later. I want to put it in around over here. Okay. Okay, the first known printings were somewhere around 1482 in Spain, in Portugal. 1482 in Spain and Portugal, a number of Masechtas were printed. I didn't bother writing them all down because in 1482 specifically, Brachas, Chagiga, Kesuvas, Kiddushin, and Tainus were printed. A little later, the Bubba's Beitza Yavamas Megillah, Moed Katan Nida Nadarim, and another like 8-9 Masechtas.
Is that really a bad thing that they're printed?
It's a bad, no, it's not a bad thing. And the point is you see more or less that once the knowledge of the process hit the world at large, it didn't take to Jews long to figure it out and apply it, and apply it to printing Sephardim. Yeah.
How did they figure out Gersa?
Okay, Gersa, just wait a second. Well, let's just go one more point. I want to, Rabinowitz points out, and this is absolutely pashut, that pre-Venice 1, there weren't whole sets printed. In other words, different mesechtas were printed. And we only have, let's say again, from the prince in Spain and Portugal, let's say we had like 20 so mesechtas. 20 of the Masechtas. It's very logical to believe that there were more printed and just lost because of the expulsion. I mean, that's very logical to believe. And of course, he doesn't point this out, but again, Jews don't print books to put them on their shelves. They print books to use them. And I believe I once read, but it's been a long time, it's been close to 20 years, I believe I once read a book that claims you should assume, I don't remember if he said 5% or 10% of Kislev Yad survived. Yeah, because they were used. 5 to 10% survived. They were used. They aged and they were used.
So,
in other words, even though we can only quantify 20 Masechtas having been printed in 1482 and 1486, even that's all we can quantify, it's logical to believe they printed more. Because they were printed and they're just lost. I mean, we can't prove one way or the other, but again, it's logical to believe. It's similarly true, the first things printed in Italy were in San Sino, 1484. And that's why the San Sino Press, what's the San Sino Press? Because that is the, in other words, historically, in a linear historical fashion, just like Columbus sort of discovered America, but really, you know what I mean? Columbus discovered America. So literally, it starts in San Sino. Even though there's these prints out in Spain and Portugal, because that Jewry was totally wiped out in 1492, 1496, then those printings don't lead into the other ones. The San Sino printings lead straight into the Venice printings. They lead straight into it. So that's why San Sino is considered such, historically speaking, an important place. Okay, so in 1484, the first thing they printed was Brachos. They printed Beitza not long afterwards.
Wait, that's not the order of
shots.
I mean, they didn't do it all.
Well, yeah, no, both, it seems Brachos was one of the first things printed by almost everybody. I guess because it's fun and popular. I guess, I don't know. It's a good question.
It's a Shana album.
Something like that. It's a Shana album, something like that. That's a cute idea. But, okay, whatever, you know. So they printed Nach with the Radak in 1485, 1486. Bubba's Ksuvas Nidachuan, 1478. Most of these had Rashi and Tosas, but there are one or two that only printed Rashi.
And Steinsaltz.
Right. And Steinsaltz, right. Okay, now, this is also so historically important.
Do you have copies of those commercials?
Yes, there are. Rare copies. I didn't have time to note every time he says, this one I have, this one I saw, these I didn't see, but I have accurate reports of, I didn't take all those notes down. But yes, some of them are still extant, is the proper word for this. And again, as Rabbi Rabinowitz points out.
About Alan Schwartz says.
What?
I think about Alan Schwartz says. He collects very great.
Sancinos?
I'm not sure if he has.
If he has, they're worth a lot.
Yes, yes.
A Sancino Gemara. One would assume, I can't imagine it's worth less than $20,000. I can't imagine. Okay, when we were in Prague 2.5 years ago, almost 3 years ago now. So Reb David Kamenetsky was there with us, and Reb David Kamenetsky is a dealer in Judaica, and they had out Chumash Rashi printed in 1500 something or other in Prague, by Reb Avram from Prague. And he said that sefer is worth at least $50,000. Minimally. So I'm guessing that, you know, these are rare. One would guess that it's a Sina Gemara. There can't be more than 10 copies of any one Sefta. That's what I would just guess, approximately. It's got to be worth a lot of money, I mean. Okay, anyway.
So, what was the idea behind it? Wait a second.
Why did they originally print, in other words, before Venice won, the famous Bamberga, Daniela Bamberga's printing in 1520 to 1525 or so, before that printing, they didn't print an entire set. You want to know why? Why did they only print individual Masechta? Is that what you want to know?
More than that, why would some people do Rashi without Tosas?
Oh, okay, I mean, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure. There's only one or two Masechta. Most printings have Rashi and Tosas. Some is only rare to only print Rashi. One guess is Tosas is not really Shavu Chol Nefesh. Tosas is not for everybody. And it could have been monetary constraints also. Who knows? Good question. Impossible to prove one way or another. Yeah, that's right. If you take out Tosas, it makes it a lot smaller. Okay. Fine. Okay. What was the constraint of printing the entire Shas? That was, it was too big of a project to do without the Pope's official approval. Too big. You could print one Masechta and get away with it.
Printing the entire Shas. What's the difference between printing 32 volumes of Brachos and printing 32?
It's not clear if every single Masechta had been printed before that. It's probable they had, but not all in one place. The point is, it was, most of the printings were in Italy. And Italy is close to the Pope. It's a big mystery, which no one knows why. Why is it that in Salonika and Constantinople, which were under Turkish rule at the time already, why there wasn't an entire Shas printed for quite a long time? It's an excellent question. They were not poor communities, as we saw already. They hired, the Constantinople-Istanbul community had at least three rabbanim hired full-time. Chief rabbis, other rabbis, they had a lot. They were not a poor community at all.
Did they have full shas in the community?
Hard to know. Very difficult question to know. But in terms of Western Europe, the only Jews who owned his Jews allowed to live was Italy and ecclesiastic states in Germany. They're all subject to real church control. And therefore, to do a major project, you could only do with official permission.
And we'll
get there in a couple of minutes. What?
Did they petition for that?
Eventually they did. Well, we'll get there. That's one of the great ironies.
To make a shot back then, how much would it cost?
We'll get there in a minute also. I want to wait a moment, and we'll get to that. What was the economic constraints? That's an important issue, and we should get there soon. Okay, so we got most of this done. Wait a second. Just one more point. One more point while we're over. This is very important. This you guys have to hear. This is so important. Okay. We have a Gemara here. Great. We have a Gemara. Watch. Okay. The first time Dibur Hamaslos were put into Shas was by Venice
One.
Until then, what I mean Dibur Hamaslos is with a dot. You see the dots here in Rashi and Tosas? Separating the quote from the Gemara with the rest of it?
Was the quote from the Gemara there?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
The quote, it read straight.
And now, that's so significant.
A lot of it was still
okay. I see. Here we have a nice shot of Becca. I thought it was wise. It's very simple. In Tosas, it's relatively clear. Let's say 80% of the time, Tosas starts his real story with V. Tomar. So you obviously know beforehand is a quote.
Or Pirush Rashi or something.
Or Pirush Rashi, that's right. So in Tosas, it's not as critical. There are some Tosas in the world make a difference. It's even closer to 95%, but I didn't think about it. This is just a point I only realized recently. And you have to keep your eyes open. And I'm not, definitely not to say I'm not big enough bucking shots, not the right word. You have to ask someone like Rav Shmulevitz, or Tzvi Cheshen, one of these people who can literally spit shots at you right now. They'll be able to you tell them this fact, and then they'll start going wild over it. Okay, so the idea of Dibur Maskel is a printer's idea from the early 1500s.
You can tell it is incorporated in the Rashi and Tosas in a lot of cases.
In Rashi specifically, there's two types of Rashis. Some Rashis, you were supposed to read the Rashi straight in without that dot. And other Rashis, you're not. And again, it doesn't take immense, you know, scholarship to figure that out. I'm not Chas V'Shalom trying to, you know, insult you, Chas V'Shalom Menachem. I'm just telling you, that's just a fact. And you see it, you feel it much more clearly in Rashi, but it's important to realize that you're not actually feeling something. It's really ki'ilu, in terms of Jewish history, a recent innovation. And that's if we view Jewish history like this. It's a recent innovation. Okay. One other very important fact I just can't resist, even though I don't know if I have time to say it, but I'm going to say it anyway. Okay, the second big place for printing Shas, after Sansino closed down, the Sansino people moved to a place called Pisra. It's also in Italy, and they printed a lot of Shas, again, about, let's say, about a third to a half of Shas. And most importantly for a history class, when they printed Bab Basra, they had a very different version of the Rashbam in most of Cheskas Abatim. Oh yes, they had what is termed today as Rashbam HaKotzer, the truncated.
Wow.
It's quite different. I mean, quite different. It's different, but similar, but different.
There's no way it was Rashi.
No, it's definitely not Rashi. It says before also. It says Kan Meis Rashi Mikan Mikan Perish for Perish Rashbam. There's no way it's Rashi. The problem is. We have no, there's no extant Kisvayad manuscripts about that, like he will verify this, the Rosh Bamakatsu. That doesn't mean it's not valid, because it is valid. But it's a mystery, it's a big mystery where exactly where it came from. But again, someone printing, you know, Josh asked, like, say 15, 20 minutes ago, what do they do? And so it's important to understand there's always at least one basically competent Talmud Chacham involved in printing a Shas. And they did. What did they do? They did the best they could do. The reason why we can have what's called more or less standardized text is not because of the original printers. It's because of the work of Rabbi Shua Boaz, the Masoros HaShas, and the Maharshal. These are the people who really worked Shas over in a way that we have basically a standardized text. Of course, the other point is the text of the Gemara is not in a vacuum. We have the Rishonim. And we can see from the Rishonim. I mean, the rule of thumb is that the Girsa in the Gemara, let's say, between 85 to 95% of the time goes with Rashi. There is a, you know, people will say, I know people 2 years ago, when I was your age, someone told me, we always have Rashi's Girsa. So that's not true. We don't always have Rashi's Girsa. There are, if you keep your eyes open, you'll notice, there are, I don't know if it's 5%, 8%, 2%. No, it's not always different. I mean, substantially in love this different Girsa in the Gemara than what Rashi says. It does exist, but it's rare. So life is not a vacuum, and of course Kisvayad were available to the public at large till at least 1600. Now, okay, let's go on. Salonika, they have. This is like a big mystery, which no one. I'm not sure if anything more recent than this has been done about it, but. They printed the Rif and all the Mefarshim around 1500, and by 1520 they had printed most of the classics, excluding Shas, for some funny reason. Midrashim, Mishravim, Mishim, Kulmas, Sefri, Sefra, this, that, the next, Rambams, etc., etc., etc. It's fascinating. But Shas, they didn't get around to printing Shas. Shas, they printed around 1520, they printed a number of Mesechtas in Salonika. Now, Salonika, if it wasn't mentioned, Salonika was home to many Yotzei Sfard, to many Spanish exiles, and that's where Rabbi David's family originally comes from. Due to the position of Salonika in Europe, which is northeastern Greece, there's been a lot of movement in and out of Salonika, and people estimate that even though the Kihila, the community was totally Sephardic and dominated in terms of minhag and, you know, intellectual domination by the Yotzei Sfard, by the people who came from Spain originally. Nonetheless, approximately 40% of Salonican Jews are of Ashkenazi descent. even though maybe they're not even, some of them are aware of it, some aren't aware of it. There's just a lot of movement ins and outs. So that was a major, Salonika was a major printing place in the early 1500s. So, you know, again, as I say, I mean, I don't know how in the world anyone could have the absolute chutzpah, and I'm not sure if this, we should be classified as deliberate falsification or projecting his understanding of secular history onto Jewish history. I'm not sure if it's one, the both, who knows, but I mean, I think it's really just, oh, let me just finish this and you'll have a day. Don't forget your question. I think it's really quite apparent that Jews were very excited by the advance of the printing press and took as much advantage of it as possible. Should we do economics and then get to you? You want to ask your question first? Yeah, please.
Just considering the, I guess, how new the Shulchan Aruch was, you know, in relation to at least now, you know, I'm not sure what the authority it held was, but it's very possible, is it possible that his thought process behind that is that the Rabbanim were worried that we're going to open up the Gemara to people who have codified halacha, and they're going to see the alternatives when they've never been, for people who don't...
Shulchan Aruch comes in the 1570s.
Right. Oh, and this is
1700. We're talking in the early 1500s. We're in the late 1400s, early 1500s.
Right. So
I don't get like Shas is printed. Shas is printed and available to the public at large before Shulchan Aruch. And Shulchan Aruch was not universally accepted. It took time to get universally accepted. I mean, it was basically accepted, but it wasn't universally accepted. Okay. Economics and Shas. Now there is, this is like Kilu, someone with an agenda is gonna take this out of, completely out of, so it's like taking so out of context that it practically, well, he doesn't bring this as a proof, but I suspect this is what he thinks is a proof to his theory. She doesn't bring this, but again, this is my suspicion. It is true that Rabbanim, rabbis through the ages, put Chorumim on not printing Shas once someone was printing Shas. Now, I'll tell you the standard approach. Okay, there you go. That was copyright law was invented by the world at large in the late 1700s, early 1800s, for one of the reasons I'm pretty sure I mentioned here is because Daniel Defoe and Robinson Crusoe. The guy wrote a book, it was a world international bestseller, translated into 5 languages, and he died a pauper. And people thought that just wasn't right. It just was, because there's nothing to stop you once a book's in print, and you know how to make print, just do it yourself. So, the way the Rabbanim understood that's a problem, it was a major financial issue to go print a Shas. It took capital. Someone was risking a lot of money, and they could have to flee for their life in debt if it didn't work out. So the way that the Rabbanim ensured that a person taking such a major financial risk didn't get hit was they didn't allow anyone else in X amount of area go into the printing business because it just was dangerous. Now they said, because they also understood that everyone cannot afford to pay for a Gemara. Things simple like Chumash and Siddurim, there was never such a thing on. And it was an issue, and the reason why it did apply to Shas, it wasn't a form of mind control. We don't want people to learn. It's Mamish not true. The Jewish ideal has been, it could be shown now, 300 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, the Jewish ideal is people should be educated in Torah. Okay, anti-Torah things, that's a different thing. I'm not disputing the rebuttal against anti-Torah things, but I'm not disputing that. But Torah, the Jewish ideal is people should have it. The reason why they're haram has nothing to do with trying to live and keep the books out of people's hands so the rabbis can do everything. That's not what it has to do with. It has to do with financial considerations. And it's fakir. He should be impressed that Rabbanim conceptually understood the idea of copyright law over 200 years, almost 300 years before secular courts came up with the idea.
These copyright laws also helped people, meaning without these copyright laws, nobody would be able to invest that kind of money.
That's right, absolutely.
But they were actually encouraged.
Absolutely, you're right, absolutely. The copyright law was to, with this, what we could call proto-copyright law, was in order to encourage people to take the risk of such a major sum of money. Okay, now.
This is assumed, right? That it's a
pro copyright. No, it's not assumed. It's explicit. Everyone, if you learn the sugya of copyrights, which I did, I spent a month on it. Then you will know that no, it's not assumed. It's said explicitly in the tshuvas. It's open. It's not. It's like the rabbanim say one thing. This is why we're doing it. Yet this guy comes and says they said that, but they really meant something else. you know, and it's like, it's like, it's not just creative, it's just like, it's like making a conspiracy theory out of something which there's no reason to like come up with something else. I'll give you a different example. And I told this, you know, any of you guys know Barnea Sullivan?
He's a big archaeology guy.
The archaeology guy? How do you know Barnea? Okay, whatever. Old family friends. He's a very good friend of my brother-in-law's, and I know him for literally 30 years, I think. Almost 30 years. Close to 30 years. Okay, so Barnea is, I call Barnea, Migdalia tour guide, Shavia Meir. He's from the Bay, he's expensive, but he's better than any other tour guide. Like, he's like head and shoulders above every other tour guide. Okay, he's a tour, he's an archaeologist, whatever, he's a from guy, but today, but he's very, much, much better than anyone ever. Anyway, so, I went with him on the coastal tunnels once. Part of it was, I wanted to observe his presentation. So they got to a part where it looks like they stopped in the middle. So he said, over the standard statement there is they stopped in the middle and no one can figure out why. So I said to him, Barnea, what do you mean no one can figure out why? So we're supposed to come about Basra Daftalo, what's your problem? Mora says about Basra, that Herod wanted to build it. And he said, the Romans won't allow it. He said to Babamutu, what am I going to do? So he said, Babamutu says, send a messenger the long way. Tell him to take his time. Tell him to play games in Rome and take the long way home. And in that amount of time, you'll be able to build the baby to redo the whole thing. So I say, okay, done. Here you see archaeological proof to it. He says, oh, you know, that's really a good idea. I should really say that. I mean, look, you know what? If you don't want to accept everything in Shas as historical fact, if you're not from, I like, in an intellectual fashion, I understand where you're coming from. But over here, there is no other explanation than what says in Shas makes logical sense. So what in the world? This is nothing compared to the amount of proof from Tshuvas that the idea was proto-copyright law. It's there. So why do you have to come up with something fanciful? So they really meant something. What, they really meant something else? They said what they meant. They meant what they said. And you know, as they say, you're supposed straight from come. What are you coming? Oh, it's just crazy. It's wild. Okay, for practical, as long as we're finished, let's just finish off now. Printing. Bambergo really printed 3 editions of Shas, which I was not aware of last time I went over this. The first one was 1520 to 1523. What's important really is, though, what?
You made it different than any other one you made.
No, because again, Bambergo printed the entirety of Shas. He got permission from whoever, I think Leo X or whoever it was, to do it. Though this is, again, I said this before, this is a problem that secular historians have. A very typical problem. The documents say the reason. Do you know why Leo X gave permission to print Shas? To convert Jews. They convinced them, if you print Shas, then you'll be able to convert the Jews easier. It was possible that there was some money handed over also to him to do this. It's possible. I have no proof to that at all. I'm just like, I'm like literally shooting from the cuff right now. But
the Jewish probably was money involved.
So Menachem says that the Jews are involved. There's probably money involved.
That's why the first person to write about the medieval economic.
Okay. Anyway. So to assume because permission given by the church was given, the permission given to print the entirety of Shas was in Kiel and Torah to convert Jews, then that means that the majority of those Gemaras were used by non-Jews. It's like, okay, you know, like, that's like, you know, it's said in the Constitution of the Soviet Union that there's freedom of religion. So a confused historian in 200 years could say, all their law books talk about, they constantly talk about freedom of religion, freedom of religion, freedom of religion. Okay, very good. That's what it said, but I don't know what's going on. And don't tell me it's a document against a document. But that's their problem is you're out of touch with Jewish history, you're out of touch with the fact that the Rabbanim, the Jews got involved in printing as quickly as they could and printed as much as they could. We didn't even know, we're not even sure the extent of it. So how can you come and tell me the main purpose of all this was for Jews? It's true, there were Christian Hebraists, did exist. I know they existed. But that was the main market. I got some copies may have gotten into Jewish hands. Some copies, that's such bull, that's like absolute ignorance. I it's hard for me to believe that the vast majority of copies did end up in Jewish did not end up in Jewish hands. It's very difficult for me to believe. If they would have, most of them ended up in non-Jewish hands, they'd still be around. Because they don't use their books as much as we do. They don't, you know, when you learn a Daf Gemara, the Gemara is not, it's not dry. You know, people get really excited and can start screaming and yelling. So, years ago, all this, I don't remember exactly, it was at least 15 years ago, if not closer to 20 now, I had a guy over my house, Shabbos, of course, scraped off the wall. That means Jesse Del Mary Schuster sent him to me. He's a professor of Judaic studies in some university in Canada. Can't remember any other details than that. So one of the parts of his program is to teach people how to learn a Daf Gemara. Okay, he himself didn't really know how to totally learn a Daf Gemara, but he didn't. But he appreciated. I mean, he grew up in a totally secular Jew, and I'm not sure if he was Mamash Shomer Shabbos. He wasn't. He was definitely very close to him. He definitely, whatever. He made a lot for a person like that. He did quite well. He did nice accomplishment in life. And he noted that, you know, after he got kids, his students into learning in Gemara, he would just, you know, like, he'd just supervise, and they would be like screaming and yelling at each other. And other professors would come by and say, what are you teaching these kids? I can't get kids so into what they're learning. You know, that's because Torah's alive. Torah's alive. It's a live text. It's not, if you leave it dead, then you miss the point. Okay. So now, what's important is that, again, Bamberger printed three editions. And what was really important is there's a different guy whose name was Justinian, who printed a different edition in around between 1546 to 1551. And Justinian is the guy who hired Yeshua Boaz to be the editor. I thought it was Bamberger, but it's not true. It's Justinian hired Yeshua Boaz to edit Shas. And he's the one, that's when all the Marmor Kamos were added in. It was from Justinian edition, which is called Venice 3. This is the third Shas print, his first, third set printed in Venice. That is when Yeshua Boaz did his very, you know, groundbreaking, historical, important work in terms of, you know, Marmor Kamos, etc., etc., etc. Now, just to finish off, just two little last points, is in 1553, Julian III, I think that's the right name in English. He only has it in Hebrew, so I don't know. You know, Hebrew and English don't exactly transliterate exactly. I don't think it's Julius, I think it's Julian. They convinced him to burn Shas. He was convinced, Ki'ilu, almost of course, almost every, all, I think historically speaking, if not every, almost every case of convincing non-Jews to burn Svarim was instigated by Jews who converted. And this is another one of them. So this is the great printing, the great era of printing of Shas in Italy is over. It's gone. Because after 1553, they weren't allowed to print Gemaras. However, Alma Yisrael, as it could be said, and printing moves straight into Poland from there, which was anyway the heart of Judaism at that point. And starting 1559, that's 6 years. 6 years later already, the first Shas is printed in Lublin. And the Maharshal who died in 1572, apparently, it's not clear, I was not able to clarify exactly when he did it, and if he was using the Venice. People assume he was using Venice 3, but I'm not convinced that's true. It's very possible he was using Lublin 1. This is a very interesting, it's actually sort of important, because when you're looking at the original Maharshal's Hagos, the original Maharshal's Tikkunim, then you have to understand where he came from and where he's going to. And let's say, I would guess, my guess is about 60% of them have just been incorporated into the text by today. So the Maharshal, Shlomo Luria, and, you know, printing his Hagos in Shas is somewhere between 1575 and 1585, which is slightly posthumous, but that is what happened. And from there on, Shas, I would say, once you get the Hagos from Maharshal, more or less, Shas is basically a standardized text. Of course, you know, anyone who thinks that Torah is static means they've never learned anything. That's what it means. It means they didn't learn. And do you think that Rabbanim weren't aware of other Girsos, etc., etc.? Again, that just means you're out of touch with reality. But still, again, we basically have the standardized Shas from the late 1500s. And that's definitely a major accomplishment. Adkant guys. That's the year.